Hello, my name's Dave Emery, and in this half-hour segment, we're going to complete our reading of an article from the Israeli publication Monitin, that's spelled M-O-N-I-T-I-N, and I'm probably mispronouncing that. This particular publication was from an issue of Monitin in early 1991, the cover letter that I read in the first half-hour segment from the then-deputy editor of the publication, Diane Shalem, was dated April 7th of 1991, and there are some references in this article to the Persian Gulf War. So this was, in all likelihood, from an issue of Monitin in early 1991, one of the first 3 months of 1991. I showed the Israeli text, obviously in Hebrew, to someone who spoke Hebrew. That person did not see a date on this, so I cannot give you a precise date for this article, but again, it's from the Israeli publication Monitin from the first quarter of 1991. In this article, which discusses nuclear cooperation between Germany, the Bormann Organization, Argentina, and South Africa, and as we'll see, a related program in which missile technology was being developed jointly between Iraq, Argentina, and Egypt, with a generous, sort of a midwifing role by the Bormann Organization. That's what the focal point of this article is, and as I've noted, this story appears to contain the most up-to-date information that I've seen on the Bormann Organization, and indicates that the inner core of the group maintains ranks and a hierarchy very similar to what was maintained in Nazi Germany. And again, I've referred in many programs to what I call the Underground Reich, and I mean that absolutely literally. It's a Third Reich gone underground and perpetuating itself, and with a whole new generation, an old generation that had been Hitler Youth and are now in their mature years, and probably several more coming up after that. If this appears crazy to the uninitiated, just bear in mind that in RFA 37 we discussed the Reinhard Galen spy outfit, and that even when Galen was ostensibly a prisoner of war, he was reporting to Admiral Karl Dönitz, who succeeded Hitler as the nominal head of state of Nazi Germany, and also with Franz Halder, his former chief of staff, indicating that the German chain of command was still in effect even when Galen was ostensibly working for the Americans. We've accessed information from the landmark book The Beast Reawakens by Martin A. Lee, published by Little Brown and copyright 1997, and that indicated that the Bormann Organization, or the Galen Organization, rather, was little more than a front for the Odessa and worked at cross purposes with the United States, including working with the Soviets, the very entity that they were supposed to work against. And we've also seen in past discussions that even Galen himself reported to Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo and the deadly security director for the Bormann Organization. In RFA 37, specifically in the September 20th installment of RFA 37, and also in a replaying of that as part of the Why Johnny Can't Identify Il Duce miscellaneous archive show, we took a look at the fact that when the Naumann coup attempt, headed up by former Goebbels propaganda aide Werner Naumann, took place in the early 50s, it revealed that Germany was basically being run by a sub-Rosa Nazi structure built on individual cells. It was called, referred to as a Führungsring, and it was a system of mafia-like control in which the control of Germany was effected through small underground cells, and the controlling entity was based in Madrid, literally a Nazi government in exile, and that was reported in the newspapers at the time. Major newspapers such as the London and New York Times, the Frankfurter Rundschau, and others reported this very important fact, and yet that's a fact that has been largely submerged. When I refer to the Underground Reich, the directing element of it, as far as I can tell, is the Bormann Organization, and when I say Underground Reich, I mean that quite literally. The Third Reich did not disappear. It went underground. And for those to whom this might seem incredible, just think of the mafia. People are familiar with the mafia and the fact that it has perpetuated itself over generations in an altogether effective yet underground and very deadly fashion. Well, the Third Reich is a lot more powerful and deadly than the mafia, and the mafia is plenty powerful and plenty deadly. The Third Reich has done the same thing. It went underground and exists today, and is probably even more important and more dangerous today because people think of it as something that disappeared. Nothing could be farther from the truth. We're going to return to this manuscript, and I'm going to overlap the discussion slightly with the discussion that took place in the first half hour, this by way of resuming the thread of the text here. And speaking of the Bormann Organization, the author of this article writes, My research indicated that, speaking of SS generals who fled Germany at the end of the war, my research indicated that these generals and their sons are running one of the largest and most ingenious information systems comparable to any in the United States and Western Europe. This reference, obviously, to the intelligence organization of the Bormann Group, headed up by former SS general and Gestapo chief Heinrich Müller, the security director for the Bormann Group. Continuing, the mission of this network is to present as unreliable every and any report or written words about the Bormann organization and the entire Nazi group in South America. Such a system, such a network, is there to conceal the amount of businesses, contracts, and so forth that amount to billions of dollars. They, speaking of the Bormann Group, are the biggest lenders on the South American continent, and, above all, they are responsible for the research and development of a nuclear arms system in Argentina and Brazil. It has to be said, and said again, that American secret intelligence agencies such as that in the State Department cooperated, and still do, with the Bormann Organization. After all, these executives of foreign affairs, some in the headquarters of American intelligence, were those who helped stabilize Europe at the end of World War II. There were 50,000 Nazis who emigrated from Europe to Argentina at the end of 1946. These officials put a lot of successful effort into preventing the publication of my first book on the subject in 1981. This is obviously authored by, this part of the article written by Paul Manning. Continuing, of the suppression of the book, we read, resuming again with a discussion, these officials put a lot of successful effort into preventing the publication of my first book on the subject in 1981. They were trying so hard and did not hesitate to send an executive agent to Mr. Nelson Doubleday, the former owner of the publishing house with which I had a contract to publish this book. This agent managed to persuade the publisher to cancel the contract and thus to prevent publication of my book. Afterwards, I succeeded in finally having the book published by a courageous but small New York publisher. These agents went right on attempting to prevent the sales of my book, as well as mention of it in magazines and newspapers and on radio and TV stations. We should also mention that the Bormann Group has worked very closely with, among other agencies, the CIA in the past. Also, don't forget that the head of Lyle Stewart had his legs broken the week that the Manning book was published. And the reference here is to a new book, In Search of Martin Bormann. As far as I know, that book never came out, and that would appear to be why Jerry Manning, Paul Manning's son, was murdered in New York in 1993, basically to intimidate and prevent the publication of that book, and that appears to have been successful. Manning goes on to comment here via the quotes in the article. In my new book, I tell of my interview with Dr. Grunbaum, the German nuclear scientist who worked at the Nuclear Physics Institution in Karlsruhe. Grunbaum shared with me very accurate and amazing details of how West Germany signed several agreements with Argentina, and how, according to these agreements, Germany was able to join the exclusive, small club of the very few countries that have the ability to produce thermonuclear power. Dr. Grunbaum, again that's Grunbaum, provided me as well with exact details of the Bormann organization's activities and the ways this corporation sponsored nuclear activities. In order to check out and find out dates, places, and such information, I worked with Dr. Grunbaum in Strasbourg and in New York, too. I have to admit that I never witnessed before such a close surveillance as was done towards this man by German intelligence. One time, I had a call from him from Switzerland, and I could sense fear in his voice and discouragement. He told me that when he was in his hotel in Paris before he went to Switzerland, his notebook that he carried everywhere was stolen. It had recorded in it all the details about the development of German nuclear power in Argentina. Then, that same day, when he was passing from France to Switzerland at the border, his car was surrounded by French secret police agents. To his surprise, they searched and took apart his car, trying to find a copy of these notes that had been stolen. But he had a copy of these notes in Switzerland. In my eyes, this tale is not weird, for I have no doubt that elements in the French secret police that had been connected with the Nazi intelligence organization actually had their agents search the scientist's car. In a later to me from Strasbourg, he wrote, quote, I am sure the next time we both go to South America, I can point to you clearly the people of, the executives, and the major people of the Mormon organization. When the book is published, you will find detailed all the evidence for the facts you read in this article. By the way, as far as I know, again, the book was never published. Continuing with the text here, quoting Manning, friends of mine who were enemies of the Nazi ethic passed to me some telegrams that the U.S. intelligence were trying to take away. These messages had been sent from the secret offices of those concerned with Bormann and Bonn, Germany, to their branches in Argentina. One of these messages, that is dated October 18, 1990, says, quote, we plugged the leak, unquote. It was on this date that Mrs. Leon Grunbaum responded to John Loftus's call by stating, quote, Leon is dead. Also in the Moniton article, the Egyptian-Iraqi death connection. The participation of Egypt, along with the U.S. and Allied forces in the Persian Gulf War, helped the Egyptian President Hosni Mubarak show the world and make it believe that Saddam Hussein's ambitious plans to develop chemical and biological and nuclear power have nothing to do with the Egyptian scientists and their financial sources. Egypt preferred that none of the nuclear arms would be developed on its territory, since Israel is right next to it. That is why Iraq was chosen for that task. There were two important reasons for Mubarak's decision in this matter. Mubarak, it would seem, is showing an incredible personal sensitivity, an unusual one, about locations of nuclear facilities in Egypt. So great is his sensitivity that he even objected to the construction and use of nuclear power stations in Egypt. It seems that the Egyptian national trauma about the damage that could happen to the Aswan Dam is leading Mubarak's objections. The Egyptians are living in dread that one day the dam will collapse and the following horrible disaster will happen to the nation. The Nile will overflow and will wash out the entire delta and the major Egyptian cities along the Nile, a modern flood. Mubarak does not want to add any more to the trauma already there. However, the second reason is much more practical and is connected to Grunbaum's and Manning's story. That is, the German influence in Iraq was always very strong. By the way, the profound Nazi influence on Iraq and Saddam Hussein and the involvement of key German corporations, obviously at their foundation tied to the Bormann Group with the arming of Iraq, is discussed in a pair of half-hour segments entitled Uncle Sam and the Swastika Redux. Those are available from Spitfire. Returning now to discussion of the profound influence of Nazi Germany and contemporary Germany on Iraq. The Germans, for instance, were never fascinated, as were the British and the Americans, with Saudi Arabia. They were always drawn to Iraq. The high point of German influence in Iraq was during World War II. The Iraqis supported Hitler. Therefore, is it any wonder they support Saddam Hussein? This support was so great that in 1941, Ali Rashid rebelled against the British, at that time governing Baghdad, in order to establish a pro-Nazi Iraqi regime. The rebellion failed, and Rashid and his allies fled to Nazi Germany. In the 1950s, when Nasser was in power in Egypt, Rashid found shelter in Egypt. Mubarak was aware of the deep and close relationship the Iraqis have with Germany. He hoped that these connections would give the Arabs the money and the technology to develop nuclear arms and missiles. The Germans, or according to Paul Manning, the Bormann Organization, were those who established the partnership between Argentina and the Iraqis and Egyptians to develop the Argentinian missile Condor II. The missile was developed by a German scientist who worked in Argentina's laboratories of the arms industry. It was the Egyptians and the Iraqis who named it Condor II. Since 1985, the Americans tried very hard to persuade the Argentinians to drop the missile project, but the Argentinians let the Americans know that the pressure had to be on Bonn, Germany. They said as well that when the development of the missile is complete, it will serve the German army as well as Argentina, Iraq, and Egypt. Confidential American pressure on Germany was unsuccessful. In early 1989, the Americans learned that the missile was just about complete, and German scientists were about to begin experimenting with it. At that point, the Americans let the Argentinian president, Carlos Menem, know in no uncertain terms that they would allow no production of the missile. Thereupon, Menem agreed to give up production of the missile and received in return a few hundred million dollars. For the Borman people, it did not matter at all. They did not care whether Egypt or Iraq ended up with the missile, as long as its technology remained in German hands. In the early 1990s, an executive of the Israeli intelligence, the Mossad, was visiting the German council and presented to him up-to-date information about the involvement of German companies, most of them under the Borman organization's control, in the development and manufacture of Egyptian and Iraqi chemical, biological, and nuclear arms. And by the way, there's discussion of just that in the aforementioned pair of half-hour segments entitled Uncle Sam and the Swastika Redux, in which I talk about many of the key German corporations, including the Thyssen complex, and their involvement with the arming of Iraq, and those companies inevitably at their foundation joined two of the remarkable and deadly Borman organization. Continuing. Resuming again with this last sentence. In the early 1990s, an executive of the Israeli intelligence, the Mossad, was visiting the German consul and presented to him up-to-date information about the involvement of German companies, most of them under the Borman organization's control, in the development and manufacture of Egyptian and Iraqi chemical, biological, and nuclear arms. The consul looked through the papers for a couple of minutes, then handed them back to the Israeli, saying, "I do not believe it. This cannot be true," unquote. Now, just imagine what would have happened if the Iraqis had had not only the Scud missiles, but also the new, modern Condor II. Not only would Saddam Hussein have been happier, but also the Borman people. That, again, an article from early 1991 from the Israeli publication Monitin, forwarded to me by Peter Manning, Paul Manning's son, and translated again by Mr. Jack Sparks and Mr. Ozzy Zirkelman of Central Synagogue in New York City. I've spoken at considerable length in the past about the Nazi tract Serpent's Walk. That's a softcover edition authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall, Calverhall. It was published in 1991 by National Vanguard Books, the publishing arm, of the National Alliance, arguably the most important domestic American Nazi group. And the subject of the book is a takeover. It's supposed to be a novel. As I've stated in the past, I think this is one of the most important books ever written. I don't think it's a novel. I think it's a blueprint, a manifesto, and an outline of what is going to be done and what has been done. This book is about a takeover by the Underground Reich in the mid-20th, a takeover of the United States by the Underground Reich in the mid-21st century. I'm going to read the back cover of the book. It reads, and it's a good summation of what it's about. "The good guys win sometimes. Not always, of course. They lost big in the Second World War. That war was a victory for communists, Democrats, and Jews, but everyone else lost, including millions of GIs who were told that they were killing Germans and Japanese in order to make the world a decent place for their children to grow up, only to see things in America go from bad to much, much worse in the decades after the war. Even when the bad guys win, they sometimes grow careless and later become losers. Look what happened to the communists of Eastern Europe in the 1990s. Could the same thing happen to their erstwhile World War II allies in America? Serpent's Walk explores that possibility. It assumes that Hitler's warrior elite, the SS, didn't give up their struggle for a white world when they lost the Second World War. Instead, their survivors went underground and adopted some of the tactics of their enemies. They began building their economic muscle and buying into the opinion-forming media." Any savvy observer would recognize in that description the Borman Organization, and in FTR segments 122 and 123, I described German corporate domination of American publishing, and at the core, of course, of those German corporations, the remarkable and deadly Borman Group. Continuing with this back flap. "A century after the war, they are ready to challenge the Democrats and Jews for the hearts and minds of white Americans, who have begun to have their fill of government-enforced multiculturalism and, quote, equality," unquote. National Vanguard Books, again, this is the publishing arm of the National Alliance, the most important and virulent domestic American Nazi group, so an appropriate caveat in that regard. Researchers who want to study this book, National Vanguard Books can be reached at P.O. Box 330, Hillsborough, West Virginia, 24946. And again, I believe this is one of the most important books ever written. I don't think it's a novel. I think it's a blueprint and for what's going on and what will go on. I believe it to be a manifesto. The ISBN number, again, is 0-937944-05-X. And when I read this particular book, which I'd never heard of, somebody sent it to me while the OJ okey-doke was going on, it changed my life. I realized that I was going to have to start talking about the Borman Organization because it was pretty clear to me that what is written about in Serpent's Walk was actually taking place as I looked at the insanity that was manifesting itself on all sides with regard to the O.J. situation. And I've done a lot of work indicating that not only was O.J. Simpson framed, but that very powerful elements were involved in doing that, including some elements of the intelligence community and, in all likelihood, elements of the Borman Group as well. Returning to this, the text of this article from the Moniteau magazine, the description of the inner core of the Borman Organization is what is the most up-to-date I've seen, and it indicates, again, that at the core of the Borman Group is literally a structural hierarchy that derives directly from the Third Reich. Returning to the text here, the Borman Organization is managed today, this would be the early 90s, by Adolf Martin Borman and his sister Naomi Borman, leading a group of 20 German bankers and industrialists and economists, 10 of the Nazi community in South America, and 10 in West Germany. This constitutes one of the most mysterious and powerful groups in our world today. Their personal security is connected to the security of companies and corporations, and their money is protected and assured by a group of generals, past SS generals, and their sons. Beside their civilian titles, they carry military rankings that were commonly used in Nazi Germany. My research indicated that these generals and their sons are running one of the largest and most ingenious information systems comparable to any in the United States and Western Europe. This would appear to me to be one of the information I'm about to read from Serpent's Walk dovetails very precisely with this up-to-date, the most up-to-date research on the Borman Group that we've seen. Again, this coming from the late Paul Manning, and this from the Israeli publication Moniteau in the early 1990s. Turning again to the Nazi tract, Serpent's Walk, authored by someone who writes under the name of Randolph D. Calverhall. Again, this is something that I believe to be one of the most important books ever written. And there's discussion here about Hermann Mulder, who's the boss of the Underground Reich, and is described here in a conversation, speaking of this Mulder, again, M-U-L-D-E-R, Hermann Mulder, the head of the Underground Reich. He's one of the directors. I don't mean a director of Indico. They're just frontmen, but a descendant in the central directorate of the movement. And more about the identity of this character, fictionalized as Hermann Mulder. This is a threat by an Israeli agent to reveal the true nature of this group. It's not called the Borman Group in here, but it says, this fellow's talking to Hermann Mulder. We can also reveal your Nazi past, Herr Mueller. Wasn't your grandfather one of the big fish who got away? Heinrich Mueller, the head of the Gestapo? What does that matter now? Mulder made an angry gesture of dismissal. And again, so Mulder is actually presented as the grandson of Heinrich Mueller. And again, Heinrich Mueller, the SS general and head of the Gestapo, is the security director and the very appropriately feared security director for the deadly Borman Organization. And the description of the Borman Organization in this Moniteau article dovetails very precisely with what is in the book, Serpent's Walk. It's one of the reasons why I think Serpent's Walk is far more than the novel it purports to be. And as for the vehicle for this Nazi takeover in the mid-21st century, I'm going to reread a couple of passages I've read in numerous books. This is a discussion between two of the faithful, one guy named Wrench and one guy named Lessing. Quote, in 1945, when Germany lost, two submarines arrived in Argentina. Some of the remaining senior officers of the SS were aboard. They brought money, lots of money, a good part of the treasury of the Third Reich. People thought it was lost or stolen down in Bavaria, but it wasn't. It wasn't only Borman, there were others. Seeing Lessing's look, Wrench hurried on. They founded a colony, set up businesses, made connections. Later, they invested, linked up, developed. They built a series of interlocking corporations. The post-war boom and the recovery of Germany helped those corporations become conglomerates, then huge international holding companies based in the goddamnedest places. Yes, skipping down again, yes, everything neat and tidy, out of sight, away from the Jews and the Nazi hunters and their network of financial institutions and pressure groups. The Third World made it easier. There are fewer controls here, fewer restrictions, fewer checks, fewer regulations, fewer watchdog agencies. Less hassle with privacy. You can spot outsiders coming, like that bird in the mangrove tree over there. He can see all around his nest. They, the SS, and their descendants made friends in local governments. The Third Worlders needed know-how, money, connections, and expertise. And skipping down again, the SS, what was left of it, had business objectives before and during World War II. When the war was lost, they just kept on, but from other places. Bogota, Asunción, Buenos Aires, Rio de Janeiro, Mexico City, Colombo, Damascus, Dakar, you name it. They realize that the world is heading towards a corporocracy. 5 or 10 international super companies that will run everything worth running by the year 2100. Those super corporations exist now, and they're already dividing up the production and marketing of food, transport, steel and heavy industry, oil, the media, and other commodities. They're mostly conglomerates, with fingers in more than one pie. We, the SS, have the say in 4 or 5. We've been competing for the past 60 years or so, and we're slowly gaining. Skipping down again. About 10 years ago, we swung a merger, a takeover, and got voting control of a super corporation that runs a small but significant chunk of the American media. Not openly, with bands and trumpets or swastikas flying, but quietly. One huge corporation cuddling up to another one and gently munching it up like a great gubbing amoeba. Since then, we've been replacing executives, pushing somebody out here, bringing somebody else in there. We've swung program content around, too. Not much, but a little so it won't show. We've cut down on nasty Nazi movies, good guys in white hats and bad guys in black SS hats, lovable Jews versus fiendish Germans, and we have media psychologists, ad agencies, and behavior modification specialists working on image changes. And again, I believe this to be a blueprint for the future. It's one of the reasons why I pay as much attention as I do to the German corporate control over American publishing. And before we wrap this up, let me again give you the address, etc., for Spitfire. Spitfire, P.O. Box 1179, Ben Lomond, California, zip code 95005. Email address is spitfire@ix.netcom.com. That's spitfire@ix.netcom.com. The Spitfire website, containing a list and description of the various programs available from Spitfire, can be accessed at www.spitfirelist.com. That's www.spitfirelist.com. I get a small royalty from the sale of the archive shows only. I get no monies from recent, present, or future on-air endeavors. That concludes this segment. My name's Dave Emery. Thanks for listening.